You can hear our show on Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher allows you to listen to your favorite shows directly from your iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, or Palm phones. On demand and on the go. Don't have Stitcher? Download it for free today at Stitcher.com or in the app stores. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. You're watching Fanboy Versus with your hosts, JD Church, Nicole Hale, Chris Triplett, and Chris McFeely.
And you are watching Fanboy Versus. I am your host, JD. Joined today.
Hi, JD.
Hi.
Hello.
I have Chris McFeely and Nicole Hale with me today. Chris Triplett is out. How are you two today?
Pretty good.
Excellent.
Delusional.
Good. That's always a lovely state to be in because you can be wherever you want. Mm-hmm. So it is Fanboy versus Diversity Adversity as we talk about issues of diversity, not really, but sort of within comics as our news bit. We'll have comic reviews, hopefully a shorter show. And then at the end, we're talking about Batwoman.
You know, finally, it occurs to me, this could be quite a diverse show. We got diversity in the news. Mm-hmm. There'll be comics of people with different races and ethnicities and orientations all up and down.
That's true. It is. Ooh. See,
it's diversity. We're diverse.
It's diverse. Well, we're very white, but otherwise, we're sort of diverse. We've got international appeal and female. Well, so that's...
I'm part Native American. Does that count?
Yes, we'll take it. So there you go.
All right.
See?
Okay.
Across the board. So
there you go.
Okay, so let's get to the news. And for that, we always go to Chris. So what do you got, sir?
There's a bunch of things going on this week. Nothing too major. It's kind of been a quiet week or two for news because all of the attention is still on DC is the news. We are still halfway. We're only halfway through the New 52, but they are still taking all the news, as is the case with, for instance, today's announcement that there's going to be a flamboyantly out gay Teen Titan in the new series.
Hi.
Hello. He is wearing pink and purple and sunglasses and sweater vest.
So now they have said that the fabulous pink shirt has gone to blue. So the picture that's out has been modified slightly. They changed that color to blue. Yeah. Yeah, so I think
the character's name is Bunker, and he appears he is on the cover of the first issue of Teen Titans. Not that image that we first saw whenever Teen Titans was originally solicited, but the actual cover of the comic, which was revealed a while ago, and he's all purple and glowing and energy and the like. And we've seen a picture today as well of him in his human identity, and that's what I just described to you. The amount of gel in that hair.
Wow. Miguel Jose Barragan, I guess.
So he's not just gay. Taking all the boxes here, folks. Taking all the boxes.
Yep. Mark him down too.
He's from a very small village. He was the only gay in his village.
And the only superpowered, I think, as well. Oh, double no. Out of the closet.
Only our United Kingdom viewers will get the joke I just made.
Oh, okay. Well.
I'm not going to explain it to you. You know what to
sorry.
Say
I don't. I'm not part of the club. We ran y'all out of our
We're
country.
Not part
and
of cool kids.
We said, we don't want to know about your cool jokes and your funny humor. But
we'll take your Doctor Who.
But we'll take your Doctor Who, and we'll put a weird intro on it. Anyway,
we'll start co-producing your Torchwood. That won't turn out so well.
but we digress. So Miguel, basically, if you can't picture it, imagine that one of the contestants from Project Runway has superpowers. There you go. You have seen Miguel. I think this is one of those. I don't know. I've been milling this over in my mind for like the hour or so that I've known about it. I don't know. You know, the more I think about it, Lobdell's point in the article was that he felt that there weren't, you know, there's gay characters. There's plenty of gay characters. We're going to talk about Batwoman later. I mean, there you go. But there really they're all sort of, a lot of them are like straight people that are gay. Like, they don't, like, there is a stereotype where it's like there's gay people you can point out. And I know that from my own experience because I've got some friends that are gay that are like...
They do exist.
Right. Yes. Oh, and no it's way. Like, I mean, I have friends that are gay that are like, oh, they're gay. Oh, wow. Mm. I didn't know that. But then I've got other friends that are like, oh, yeah. You know, it's like you don't, as soon as you, it's you like, know.
I know, you know, there's one or two guys I would say I know who probably don't realize it yet.
Yes, and that happens
but
too.
Who are
but yeah.
Fabulous.
Right. So, but in comics, that's not really the norm. You don't have like superhero homosexual characters that are the what would be considered like the flamboyant type. So I'm interested. It'll either go terribly wrong or be really cool or accepted. I don't know if it's going to be like amazing. It's not going to be revolutionary, I don't think. I think the odds that it'll go bad are probably better than it'll go good, but I don't know. So we'll see. So
with this, you know, I mean, I have no strong opinion of Scott Lobdell's work right now. I've not read much by him. I just remember really enjoying the three issues of Fantastic Four he wrote in 1998. But I have no basis for judging. I hear a lot of people talking smack about him in the run up to the relaunch, but I have no.
Yeah, and that's all I really have to go on either.
But I do know Brett Booth, so I know it'll be kind of fucking ugly looking.
Well, speaking of things that are supposedly not good looking and are going to have a new writer, Static Shock.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Yeah. So they have a new writer. They don't have a new writer. They lost a writer. Was it
John
Ross?
Rosem.
Yep.
Yeah, Rosem, however you pronounce it. He is leaving the book. But he has said that it's not because of the book, and it's not because of problems with DC.
Well, that doesn't leave very many.
Yeah.
So it's probably your co-writer and artist, McDaniel, right?
You might want to come out with a more explanatory thing if that's not what you meant to say.
Yeah, it's almost like in the process of trying to explain that it wasn't DC, he probably like knocked down all of the other blocks. You know, it's like
he's going through major reconstructive surgery, and so
just
had to take. You know, you never know.
He said he would still be open for work.
No. Yeah, and I mean, and even DC's response was like, no, we love him, he's working on new stuff, and so it just seems like there must have been some friction, at least creatively. I'm not saying personally, but
I mean, when the co-writer is the guy that's drawing it, I think you could definitely see how a writer could feel that maybe their ideas were getting lost in the mix.
Yeah, and I've heard
not that I, you know, hands up, I don't know, but
yeah, and I didn't read that issue of Static Shock, so I don't even know how that first issue
See,
was.
I hate Scott McDaniel, so not personally. I just hate his art. I hate it so
I've
much.
I've heard that. I've heard bad things. So that probably.
I hear people talk good things about it too, and I'm like, are you blind? But,
so.
That I wouldn't touch anything he did with a pole.
Ooh. What else? What other news?
Being awfully negative today.
That's
well,
okay.
I guess we'll stick with negativity in the DC controversy. Suicide Squad number 1 came out this week. And,
yes!
We had, you know, bare-ass naked Harley Quinn. Not literally, but, you know, bare-ass Harley Quinn, robo-deadshot on Hammerhead King Shark, and all of the controversy that was piled up against this book was swept aside in a thunderous crash when Amanda Waller appeared on the first page and was as a skinny young hot thing.
Yeah. O-M-G, people. O-M-G.
What
the hell?
What are you thinking when you do that? Like, and they've, you know, they've come out and said, it's not, you know, I've heard the most, like, just the most limp possible explanations. Oh, this is her when she's younger. An earlier part of her career, but she'll still be the same great character, so her appearance shouldn't matter.
What? No.
Kind of stick in the reverse stance of your point there. If it doesn't matter,
then why did you do that?
Why
no.
Change
no.
It?
No,
there is absolutely no backing out or getting out of this one at all. That's a bad fuck up.
I'm getting. You know, there's been room and talk, and I don't know. It's hard to say, but. It does sort of seem like DC in... I mean, yes, there is diversity in terms of race, but in terms of, like, body type, relationship type, life type, there really is... It's very homogenous. You know, it's all skinny people. It's all single people. You know, all the male characters are...
To be fair, like, when it comes down to superheroes, you know, it's not hard to understand why, you know. You know, you have to be out there fighting crime every day. There's the predilection to having towards being muscular and athletic, you know.
Right.
I mean, but it's not like there's any shortage of like, supporting characters who might be carrying a few extra pounds. But I don't think there's anybody quite on the level of sheer force of personality and such a standout character as to be able to make the jump to the DC animated universe completely unharmed and to be contemplated for use in the movies and everything.
Well, even in Smallville.
Yeah, she was in Smallville too, wasn't she? That's right. Yeah. I forgot. As Amanda Waller. And I mean, her whole thing is bound up in the way the fact that, you know, she was from, yeah, I don't know the full thing about Amanda Waller. I've not read a lot of Amanda Waller stories, but as I understand it, she has a fairly detailed backstory about her, you know, growing up in a bad neighborhood, and despite, you know, being a woman, being black and being large and overweight, she, you know, she got where she is by sheer force of her own will and, you know, overcoming all of the things that society had stacked against her was part of that, you know. And, mm-hmm. of course, she's called The Wall. It's built into her very name,
right,
which is obviously a sidelong joke at the size of her, but more to do. It's just like a triple-barreled nickname. You know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, guys, could you screw that up anymore? I mean, I've heard some speculation that maybe she's been slimmed down because of the Green Lantern movie. She's not Hourglass in the Green Lantern movie or anything, but she's slenderer than you would expect for Amanda Waller. But, yeah, I don't know. No, that's...
There's no need. I mean, that's one of those changes that just didn't have to happen. Like, that character physically was fine. And, you know, again, this is... let's make everybody look the same, you know. She was at least a female character that had a distinctly different look, because one of the continual complaints in comics is that women in comics tend to all look the same. And, you know...
No waist and big boobs.
Exactly. And, you know... Here you had a character that wasn't that, and now, you know, that's thrown out for whatever reason. So, blah.
Poor.
Blah. So.
Any other news?
I don't know.
I got one piece, but I was just waiting to see if you had anything else.
I don't think so.
I want to end on this.
Okay.
This is one that I overlooked last week because we didn't do any news last week, and I really actually kicked myself afterwards because I really wanted to draw people's attention to this. It was the story last week of Mike Mayer, who was he's a mentally handicapped Superman fan from Illinois, who last week. He has been collecting Superman since he was no age. He has a colossal Superman collection of figures, statues, thousands and thousands of comics. And he lives on Social Security and a part-time job at McDonald's, supporting himself, just lives alone with his two dogs. Last week, an acquaintance of his invited himself into his home and stole a substantial portion of his collection. I can't believe I forgot to bring this up last week because I was so angry and sad when I heard about this. Mm-hmm. And the comic book fandom just rallied behind this case. There were news reports all over it. People started sending in all the figures and comics they could to the guy. And, you know, it was a horrible, horrible thing that made me feel so sad. I'm not a Superman collector. I don't have anything to give. I really would have, like, if there was some kind of, like, monetary collection, I would have chipped in for it, but I never found one. It was a horrible thing. But, on Friday night, just before I went to bed, I saw the news story. They caught the bastard, and he got his comics back. Yeah. Really hit the roof. I jumped with joy so high. Oh my god. And you know, he's got nearly everything back. And because of everything that everybody sent him, he has gained back almost twice what had actually been stolen.
Wow.
And now he's going to donate it to children's hospitals.
Oh, that's great.
Oh
my god. I mean, you know, it's a great story just in the way that the community came together.
Yep.
And, you know, it's one of those, with all the horrible shit that's happened in the world this year so far, it's nice to see that just like on one little level somewhere, in one small case, in the case of one man, that some justice actually got served and some good karma came around and some bastard actually got what they deserved. Caught, yeah, by the way, as the result of an unrelated crime he committed, robbing a 78-year-old.
You know, that's, yeah, what it's, I mean, like, I wish there was a hell for someone like that to burn in,
like,
because
a special hell to send somebody, yeah, somebody like that.
God.
Well, when, yeah, once he goes to jail, he'll get it, because I've had a few friends who've been in jail, and there's people, you know, even there's even a hierarchy in
the social, like, justice of jail.
Children,
yeah.
You don't mess with children and you don't mess with old folk, okay?
Yeah.
So, yeah, he'll get,
wow,
his dues.
That, yeah, and that's a heartwarming story. I mean, it's nice, especially as far as, like, the guy, you know,
I mean,
stuck
even,
out fan.
You know, if he hadn't got it back, it would still be a wonderful story of the
community come together.
The community,
yeah,
come together and just, I mean, there were so many, like, just, like, artwork collect. People were drawing pieces of art and sending them to
him. Oh, wow.
CBR's The Line It Is Drawn feature. It's a weekly feature they do where a team of rotating artists draws things based on reader suggestions, just drew pictures for him. John Bogdanova, I don't know how you pronounce that exactly, but it was a Superman artist, like an old Superman artist, like drew a piece just for him, just donated it like that. Just a beautiful picture.
Wow.
There are articles out there you can find. Maybe we'll link to it on the show notes. Just some of the places you can go to see all these things that have been done. There are little videos of Mike reading out some of the letters that he'd been sent, and just, it is like, yes, justice is, you know, the system sometimes works, and it is one of those real good, it's good. It's just happy news.
Good
happy,
deal.
Happy news.
Yay, we get to end the news on a positive note.
Yeah.
So we like to do that. Okay, so let's move on then to our reviews. We will start with Nicole.
Unfortunately, I'm going to bring it down now.
Oh, all right. See, well, we like to have like a curve to the show. You know,
so. You know what? I got to say, DC is doing a pretty fine job with their new relaunch and their reboot, but I'm going to review one that did not do too well, in my opinion.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And a shocking one at that, I guess.
Yeah,
we're shocked that this one
didn't
do well.
I'm going to be reviewing Resurrection Man. Woo! Oh. I know you guys are all excited.
No, I'm interested to hear, you know, because I've heard some good reviews on this thing. Then
really?
I've heard some... I gave it a quick leaf through. I thought it looked kind of interesting. I'm ready.
Let's
yeah, I'd be interested to hear what you say.
It's very predictable. I did not care for the artwork in it, but... Basically, the first time you see him, he's on a gurney, and I guess, because I don't know jack about Resurrection Man, that's why I picked it up, like, again, kind of like last week, I'll pick it up, and, you know, we'll learn something about this guy, right? So, that's what I did, and I'm just like, can I get my $3 back? No.
Wow.
So, basically, he's on the gurney, and I guess wherever he's at, when he dies and he gets resurrected, he takes up those elements, and so so this time though, when he's dead, he's realizing, okay, well, I'm tasting metal a lot because he's just around a whole lot of metal, but basically he's got to restart his life. He gets on a plane, like I said, and that's where he meets up with Angel of Death, and then he dies again and is resurrected again. That's basically your 2-minute summary, because we're not going to go through the whole comic book, but because we're trying to redo everything. But that's basically it. So he's been resurrected twice in this comic book. There is a good fight, but like I said,
no. The trick with this guy is that every time he dies, he comes back with a new superpower.
With a new power, yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, that's kind of cool. That's kind of cool, but it didn't wow me. The most, this just shows you what this comic did. The most amazing part of this comic book was the cloak figure that is in all the 52. Because
yeah, I did kind of roll my eyes at that one. I was leaping through it, and it was like there was no need to search for her.
Because
there
here
she was
running through the, and it's cute. The thing is, it doesn't even look like a girl in this one.
No, it doesn't. It's just,
and
it's in the foreground, for goodness sake.
Yeah, she is right there. And the thing that I noticed is the long, spindly fingers. I'm talking long, stretched out fingers. And I was like, So who is this now? Now I'm more curious about her than I am Resurrection Man. So, just when, from when this was, one panel.
When I was leafing the issue, I mean, I did think that the whole Angel of Death, if that's what she was, like an Angel of Death anyway, I was like, oh, right, yeah. That's obviously some holy, you know, it takes a while before they get around to showing you what they are in the course of the issue, but it's like, well, that's obviously some kind of heavenly being that's come down to collect him because he's long past due.
Well, that's what she was saying, you know what, you're overdue, you know, you're overdue, so...
Yeah, I got onto that pretty much immediately, and I was like, that always kind of makes me, because it's a really pat way of doing, oh, he keeps dying and coming back, does he? You know, people who survive death nearly always come, and certainly, I mean, this is what are they calling it, the subtitle for this group of books that they're doing at the minute, this Swamp Thing.
Oh, DC Dark, yeah.
Yeah, DC Dark, yeah. You know, so again, this one felt a little bit like it was maybe like Swamp Thing or Animal Man, maybe like a Vertigo book by any other name.
Everything was like forced on this one. You're just like, okay, I want, I mean, the title pretty much says it all. I'm a fan of horror stuff. I like my suspense and my gore. This just didn't do it for me, you know? Like you said, the Angel of Death, you're supposed to be scared of this person. And I'm sorry, she's hardly in it. And she did not bring out the fear. She didn't really do a whole lot for this being that's supposed to be the know-all. And so, yeah, didn't do it for me. Like I said, the hooded figure, I want to know more about
that. Wrong lesson to take away.
Yeah.
I don't know, like I said, I just gave this one a quick leaf, but I don't know, I mean, I like the look of the art in it, and the general approach to it was solid, you know, starting out with them just coming right back. I mean, it's not, you can't say you definitely weren't properly introduced to the character,
get
the feel of what the series is definitely going to be driven by these. Seems like now that every time he comes back, he has a... Well, I don't know if it's a new thing or not, but he seems to have a compulsion, an act that he needs to carry out, depending on when he gets resurrected as well. It's one of those mildly unbelievable things where, like, it's just so fortunate that the guy whose power is to be resurrected constantly always winds up in situations where he dies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that does seem a bit odd.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, like, they have, like, two little different side stories here. Both of them involve different women. And you're just like, okay, where'd this come from? They don't resolve it. It's just thrown in there. And then, like, the very last part, there's a psychic. I don't even know how he got to the psychic.
That's Madame Xanadu. So, you know, I recognize her. That's another DC character who's also in Demon Knights, and she's supposed to be in Justice League Dark as well. So she's kind of the common thread that's looped through these dark books. But if you don't know who she is, you don't know who she is.
Well, the thing is, it's just she's just there. And I'm just like, okay, apparently she's talking to him, but I don't know how he got here. I'm like, where was that progression? Like I said, and then there's this other scene with these other two women. I have no, it could have been a whole different comic for all I know. It did not make sense. It did not need to be there. And if it was supposed to be like looped into the next comic, they should have just put this little scene into the next comic because it just throws it off. It's just like, okay, I don't know who these women are. I don't see what the point is, how they're related to him. It's just, yeah. And it's right at the very end of it.
I mean, is that coming from maybe, I mean, because, like, I don't know anything about the characters either. Is it something that where it's like, if you knew, like, if we knew more about the character, it would work? Or, I mean, are we looking at just...
Like I said, it just seems like a whole new comic. You see these two women, they're apparently criminals on their own, and they like to torture people.
Oh, yes, yes, those are the body doubles. Those are a pair of supervillains called the Body Doubles. At least I believe that's who they were based on my quick reading of the comic.
Yeah,
I remember the scene now.
And it's just like...
What is it says at the end? It's the tag for the next issue. What does it say?
Double Danger.
The Body Doubles. That's how I remembered it. That's why I wasn't sure when I read it if it was them, but then...
They should have put this in here. They should have just put this at the beginning of the next comic if they're going to be introduced to the next comic. It just felt so out of place. because you're chasing him through this forest scene, and then all of a sudden they just have this two page of these girls, and then they go back into the forest. It just felt out of place.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just setting up a subplot for the next.
Yeah, I didn't care for it.
But I guess, I mean, if the comic does not at any other point in its narrative cut away, you know, when you're following, I don't know, it doesn't. If I remember right. You know, when you're just following him right the way through, except for that one cut there, it's a bit random.
It is. It's just really weird because you see him in the forest. He gets this new power. Boom! You see these two girls torturing a guy, and then boom, you're back, and you're like, wait, it was kind of like a commercial break. You know, it didn't even be there. You know, so no, this didn't. I gotta say this. Didn't sell me on picking it up another issue. So, because Animal Man last week, like I said, I never really read anything on him. I'll be reading that again. This I won't. So
now, this is by Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning, who are not really solid creator.
Yeah. And exactly. They wrote that's back one reason why I picked it up, because I'm like, oh, I know these guys. I enjoy these guys. This must have been like a side project. Oh, I wanted to get new wheels on my bicycle or something like that, so they needed to do another job.
Wow.
Yeah, it didn't thrill me, like I said, but who knows? Yep, that's
okay.
It.
All right.
Like I said, I'm more interested in the hooded figure than anything else, and that was just one panel.
Well, that is interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting part. So, okay then.
I wanna know why he has fancy fingers.
And apparently Chris is having trouble with his video, or I'm having trouble getting Chris's video.
No, it was frozen. Somebody in the chat told me.
Okay, it's still spinning, but that's fine. We'll bring it back up for those that are trying to get into the video. So, let's talk about Green Lantern.
You're going with the Lantern.
I'm going with the Lantern. I decided to go with Green Lantern.
Sold out by the time I got there. That's not
as
fair.
You said, when in doubt, go with the New 52. So,
yeah.
Basic story here is basically we have two characters that have found themselves in places they don't want to be. One of them is Hal Jordan, who now finds himself as a regular guy and no longer a Green Lantern. The other is Sinestro, who now finds himself as a Green Lantern when he didn't want to be. Basically, we see vignettes of both lives at this point. The Guardians have released Sinestro and basically just says, "Hey, go be a Green Lantern. The ring picked you. You did the oath. It works. So who are we to argue with it?" Ganthet doesn't like that, however, but then they start doing something. The other Guardians start doing something to Ganthet, and then we don't hear any more of that. Hal is a total wreck. He's completely in debt. He's unemployed. He has no way to make money. And he even at one point sees what he thinks is a domestic violent sort of scuffle across the street, runs to his window, jumps across the building, crashes in to break up this fight, and it turns out it was a film studio thing, and they were shooting a thing in the apartment. He gets arrested, but Carol busts him out, and he ends up going to dinner with her later, and that goes horribly wrong for him. at the end, we see Sinestro comes back to Hal and is basically wanting to make some sort of deal. Title of the next issue will be Deal with the Devil. So, something fun there. A couple of key points out of the issue. The big thing for me is that this is not new.
Yeah.
Which was kind of exciting.
The point is, like, this is not in any way, by any stretch of the imagination, a jumping on point or introduction.
No.
This is Green Lantern 68.
Exactly. That is exactly what I was going to say. This is Green Lantern 68. Like, I, you know, there is no variation, deviation. I mean, maybe other than the character art, a little bit of the art, which isn't even that drastic.
No, you can't see if he's got his V-neck or not because he's not in costume.
Yeah. Now, Sinestro has the tall collar too. So, yeah, I mean, we're really just in the next issue. So nothing strange is there. Hal may be a little bit more brash and feel a little bit younger than he has, but that may be just, again, some of the art. It is interesting to see both these characters sort of out of their element. You know, Korugar has been overrun by the Yellow Lanterns, which really pisses Sinestro off. And you can see his frustration at not being able to do much about it. He actually kills a Yellow Lantern and even destroys his ring before it can go back. Hal, on the other hand, one of my points of contention is, and I mentioned that there seems to be an adversity to heroes in relationships. And there's something that's a little bit out of character. I thought that we had sort of established that Carol really wasn't interested in a relationship with Hal.
Yeah, I was kind of puzzled by that.
And, you know, it's, I think, I really thought that the whole point of Blackest Night and then into the Brightest Day was that Carol had sort of made peace with the fact that, you know, her and Hal were just not going to work out. Yeah, it just wasn't going to work out. But then there's a whole sequence when they're at dinner. And the other odd thing is he's totally broke. I don't know what she's thinking. You know, in this process,
she's a good looking woman who thinks she needs to be treated like a lady. That's why.
And what, married? Like, she, but that's the whole thing is, like, he has this whole thing where he's trying to ask her for something. What he really wants is for her to co-sign on his car. Cause she's offered him a job, I guess, working back at, Ferris Air. And, so she thinks he's going to ask her to marry him.
Like, what the hell? Like haven't why? Even really been a couple?
No.
Why would she make that big mental jump? Like,
and so maybe it makes me wonder if maybe this is something that they're changing. I don't know. But it does seem very out of place. And Johns wrote all that, so I'm like, why? Yeah. It's not like that it's a new writer and they're just not informed and going in a different direction.
There was this film that came out.
Oh, there was the film, yeah. So, you know, I think that may be some of the course. I don't know. But, I mean, you know, the art in here is great. You know, I think the story is definitely, like I said, we're seeing, like, it's really just two guys really frustrated with where they're at. You know, Hal has gotten, you see the problems that Hal has just from not having the ring. I mean, he hasn't owned a car. Because he didn't have to, you know, so now he's trying to get a car. He doesn't have a job because he's not really even had to have a job. He can't fly.
How has he been supporting himself?
I guess he was. The indication is that he was, flying, that he was piloting.
He lost the job because he took the year off to do his Brightest Day crossover.
Yeah. And they actually do say that pretty early on that he had got fired because he wasn't dependable or reliable and wasn't around.
I mean,
around,
the whole point of the Brightest Day, like, was it around a 10 issues? Where the point was that he wasn't going to take the ring off.
Right. And so he was.
He didn't. So he was just Green Lantern 24/7.
Yeah. And, I mean, he's even getting, like, a shakedown here. Like, his landlord's, like, you know, basically, like, you know, pay your rent or get out. And so it's like, these are not things that Hal is used to. I've lost my crew.
No, there are things Peter Parker is used to.
Yeah, exactly.
He's not the first DC character to pull a Peter Parker in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, but it is very much that, you know, that direction. I mean,
that's a simple acknowledgement, though, of, I mean, you know, I'm not slamming DC or anything, but DC has always been about unassailable heroic paragons. Whereas Marvel has, you know, at its core, been more about relatable humans with real people problems. And
right.
It seems like, you know, in this, as part of this particular reboot, DC is like, maybe they're on to something.
Yeah, but that's the
thing,
though. I mean,
obviously,
that's like
a generalization.
Yeah, but isn't
hate mail, I know that there are characters in DC with real problems, but you know what I'm saying.
But isn't that, you know, doesn't that go back to, but that's what Marvel does. It's not what DC does, you know.
Isn't the whole point of the relaunch to go, you know, this is not your father's DC? And if they want to actually catch people's attentions with this relaunch and get new people in, maybe it is time to try and create some relatable characters. This is not this is not a time socially or culturally where unassailable paragons of virtue are the kind of heroes most people want. You know, everybody loves Superman, but when did anybody last care?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think you have a point, you know. So, yeah, we've gotten so cynical over the last 10 years. You know, 10 years ago, we wanted big heroes, and, you know, we were interested in that kind of thing because it was right after 9/11 and going into that whole mess. You know, but now it's like, you know, 10 years later, we're back to the world's falling apart and doom and gloom and all those kinds of things. So, yeah, I mean...
Why Marvel just was able to come in and, you know, 50 years ago, why Marvel came in and made such a noise, because it was like, oh my God, look at these heroes. Suddenly, they're real people with real people problems. You know, this was not something, you know, Superman's biggest problem for the 20 years preceding that was, oh, maybe Lois Lane might find out again accidentally this week.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and yeah, and that, and, you know, and that's one of my problems again with Superman is, you know, but whatever. So I don't know. I mean, I think honestly, the best part of this whole comic was the fact that it wasn't different. You know, I was a little bit worried coming off of what had happened, you know, at the end of the War of the Green Lanterns, that it's like, oh, we'll just be in a new, you know, universe. And
yeah, the thing about it was that, like, even when you reach the end of War of the Green Lanterns, Johns wasn't done. You know, the story wasn't finished. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of other DC comics, like, which were, I think the only other comic to really be struck by that sense was probably the Batman books, which have had Grant Morrison's overarching plan whipped out from under them, albeit temporarily. But, you know, I couldn't point at another DC book right now and say X, writer X, was not finished with his story on that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, some of them had the chance to sort of finish up. I mean, yeah, I think
as far
that,
as timing, like, went.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, for regular readers of Green Lantern who were enjoying it, and, you know, it's always been a pretty solid, reliable book from DC over the last couple of years with Geoff Johns at it. It's not, you know, they haven't had that whipped away from them. They get to continue enjoying that. But, you know, as a jumping on point, Timey-Wimey's just joined the chat, and he's just come in and he's reiterating what we were just saying. You know, you can't, it's not a jumping on point even remotely.
Yeah. Oh, no. I mean, yeah, I mean, it is in the sense that you're going to get to see Hal maybe get the ring back. And so, I mean, it's sort of a, you know, a pre-status quo, but you definitely don't have the lead in to understand why Sinestro has a ring or, you know, what had happened before. I mean, I think, especially with the episode with Carol, if you hadn't read it, that wouldn't bother you. So I don't know. But yeah, but for the most part, like, yeah, it does feel like familiar territory, and I do kind of feel like I, you know. That, like I said, what I was, you know, getting at earlier was that I was sort of afraid that they were going to go a route where Sinestro had been a Green Lantern and that, you know, like, they were really going to reboot a lot of this.
Yeah, I had people coming in trying to ask about the comic with me, and they thought that what we were getting here was that Sinestro had never not been a Green Lantern. They thought that was the level of reboot, and I'm like,
right,
War for the Green Lanterns, you know, War for the Green Lanterns, it's not, you're not messing with it, this is fine. Yeah. So if you could just cut that false outrage off right now, you know.
And so basically what we're going to get, and based on what's happened in Justice League, is they've just sort of shortened the timeline for Hal. Now, it may undo, I mean, God, it's probably going to undo some of, I don't know, because that's going to say you have to go 5 years that he got the ring.
I think this five-year thing we need to just ignore.
Really? Yeah. Like, is that just a smokescreen?
They can say it's 5 years, but you know what? At last count, the Marvel Universe, it's only been 13 years since the Fantastic Four came into being. Just,
yeah.
No matter how many years you condense it into, it's never going to be believable if you actually stop and try and think about it and dissect it.
True.
So I'm not going to hold that against DC. I will hold against them the fact that they seem to have made a point of advertising it's 5 years, which is just dumb. Just mention it and move on and just leave it.
Yeah, and there was
no
even...
time frame is ever going to truly be believable.
There was an interesting exchange, actually, between, a couple of creators. I know Mark Wade was chiming in on it, but it was about the timeline and that people apparently didn't understand that, you know, like, Action Comics was happening before Justice League and whatnot. So,
well, I don't know. I mean, it says actively five, you know,
it says 5 years before on Justice League.
You'd have to be not paying attention pretty seriously when you were reading Action Comics if you didn't realize it was set when Superman had just arrived in Metropolis.
Right. Because it actually says,
yeah,
just appeared a few months ago. So, But anyway, good stuff. I like it just because I have liked Green Lantern. And so, you know, it's nice. And I think that'll be true. We'll talk about Batwoman here in a little bit. And I'm assuming that'll be true as well. I didn't get to read any other Batwoman. And
yeah, I'm that's really... the show I'm going to be interested in. I have read the other stuff when you have. So I'm going to get to that in the end.
So anyway. Okay, very good. On to you, Chris, sir.
Well, is my video still frozen?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Well, you talk about something else for like 1 minute. I'm going to go log out and log in again.
Okay, very good. I will mention a couple of other things that I read which were good. One thing I will mention is Spider Island, in which we did get the reveal that
they have two that came out this week?
I don't think so. There were tie-ins. I mean, there were some of the tie-ins. I didn't read the tie-ins this week. We've got a couple of things that happened at the end of it. One is we get a six-armed, two-legged Shocker, which was just wacky and awesome. But what we've learned about the virus... Oh, there he is. Video, very good. We've learned about the virus is that it's actually turning people into sort of the mutanic spiders.
Spider Island we're talking about.
Yeah, I thought I'd mention that just real quick, the end bits.
It is positively stupid how good Spider
it
Island is.
It really is amazing. I probably didn't review it because I would have gone on and on. But it is the Queen Spider, right? Spider Queen? That
below the ending, but yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, it's in Hercules as well, so whatever, you know. Yay, we called it. It's the Queen. The Queen's behind it. Yay. Lancelot taking shitty ideas and making something good of
it. He really is sort of, he's managed to just take a shit blender and come out with...
Saga, you think that in there. The Queen, God, that was rubbish. Organic web shooters, pure...
puree on high.
The other end.
Yep, puree on high for 30 minutes, and you come out with awesome comics.
Somehow. And what's so ridiculous is how every tie-in is great as well. I mean, I haven't read absolutely all of them. I haven't read Master of Kung Fu or Spider-Girl to comment on them. But all the one-shots, Herc was out this week as well, and it was one of the best issues of Herc so far. The Avengers and the New York ones from last week, and you got the Fred Van Lente Spider-Woman one-shots coming up this week with the next Cloak and Dagger. All fried gold!
Yeah,
I couldn't tell you the last time a crossover hit this many like check marks.
Well, and not
quality.
And not only that, but like making the tie-ins matter because there's a whole deal about the fight here between Venom, and Spider King, and they even say in there, "Hey, do you want to know who Spider King is and other stuff? You should go check it out." So it's like awesome. Like I don't have to know that, but I would go read the others to kind of know that, you know.
This is doing a better job than Fear itself.
Fear itself.
Fear what?
there was a couple of cool moments in Fear itself, but they mostly involved Captain America and a gun.
I don't think I even picked it up. It came out this week. I just ignored that it wasn't
getting ready to fight.
I ignored that it wasn't on my poll, so I just let it go.
Captain America gets all up in Odin's face. That's kind of cool. And Odin has some nice moments in it as well.
That was something we forgot to mention in the news was the Mighty. They released the full picture.
Oh, did they?
Of the Mighty. No. We were wrong on one account. Who we thought was Valkyrie was actually the Red She-Hulk. So everybody else was right, though. Black Widow and the whole lot. So,
well, I am gonna get that the Fearless. Yeah, I'm gonna get that series because I'm a big hooter. So.
Anyway, okay. Well, are you ready to go then? Can we?
Yes. All okay, right. I will
excellent.
Go on.
Excellent.
Okay. Well, just before I get on to the main book that I'm going to talk about, I'm going to give an honorable mention to Journey into Mystery 627, which came out this week. I believe Journey into Mystery is double shipping this month, so that's why this issue is not drawn by the regular artist Doug Braithwaite and drawn by Richard Elson instead. And it's not Loki's not in it. It's an entirely Mephisto-centric issue.
Hmm.
See, I picked it up, but I haven't read it yet.
It's a day in the life of Mephisto as he just charts what he got up to,
cool.
talking to all the other godly entities. Like, they won't let him into the big meeting hall of all the Skyfathers at the top of reality, because one devil is much like another. But he goes and he chills out with all the other Hell Lords, and they talk about what to do. He has a personal drink with Nightmare, who's been a bit bothered about the fact he's been completely ousted as the master of fear on Earth. And the whole thing's framing sequence is this... it's a journey into mystery, so indulge me for a moment as I just read off the narration here.
Mephisto's voice?
There is a story bartenders tell about the devil. That every night at closing time, he chooses a bar and walks in the door with all the sorrows of the world on his shoulders. A bar or a pub or a saloon, wherever people sweetly numb themselves. He's not fussy. Although it's true baristas that have a similar tale set during the early morning rush involving the devil with a hangover. But then the devil walks through that door and wants to talk. And if you listen and survive, he'll give you a tip. And you'll never have to work again. Which is the sort of ending a teller can twist either cruelly or kindly, depending on his inclination. The story isn't true. But occasionally, it amuses the devil to play along. And the whole scene is Mephisto in a bar, telling a bartender about his day.
Oh my god.
Comes in a red business suit, brimstone smoking off his coat that he throws on the hat rack. And I would, if this was a normal full-length review, I would tell you how it ends. But it is, of course, the traditionally twisted return. Well, Mephisto turns to leave, and the nervous bartender says, haven't you forgotten something? Oh, yes. The tip? Baldy. And Mephisto offers him immortal life. But the guy's not stupid, like he says. He doesn't want to live in pain. He doesn't want to live forever getting old and just never dying. I think, he doesn't want to clean tables for eternity. And Mephisto promises him no pain, just glorious eternity. And I'm not going to tell you how it turns out. The issue out to find out how that one ends.
I just looked at it. I'm like, oh. Yeah.
It is once again the most beautiful fusion of modern humorous sensibility with that wonderful mythical touch about the power of thought and ideas and words that Kieran Gillen has brought to Thor and Journey into Mystery at its best. Like we normally laud Journey into Mystery on this show, but this is one of the best issues yet, as far as I'm concerned. And it's a great hint of what the book could be about after Fear itself is over and we get this Loki-centric story. It's like, hey, maybe Journey into Mystery doesn't just have to be the Asgardian book. Maybe it can be the mythical book. Maybe these stories can actually be branched out beyond what seemed to be a comparatively limited scope. You know, it's a really good self-contained story, and it gets me potentially excited for whatever else the book might do.
That would be cool.
I'm really enjoying this series. So.
Such a good book. Like, it's Daredevil and Avengers Academy are just, like, the best things Marvel's putting out right now.
Mm-hmm.
No question. But, anyway, not to downplay the next book
coming out.
So, full proper thing that I'm talking about today is Ultimate Comics Spider-Man, number one. It's the one with Miles Morales in it. Hello. So, how does this go down, you may well ask? Well, I'll tell you, it is, first and foremost, it is completely its own self-contained number one. Now, I kind of hoped with this book that we would see some elements carry over from Ultimate Spider-Man, like we would see Aunt May, Mary Jane, Gwen Stacy, maybe. But after Ultimate Fallout so unceremoniously moved May and Gwen to France just at the drop of a hat, they are not, and God knows what's going to happen with Mary Jane. It's not. But, you know, in reading it then, it truly is its own thing. It is very much about this new character. Now, how well that will go down in the face of the anger some people had at the dismissal of Peter Parker and the transformation of Spider-Man into a legacy character that he never truly has been will vary from person to person. And, you know, I don't imagine if anybody's really set in their ways against the idea this issue will turn them around. But The legacy aspect of it is very clear because it opens up with a flashback set 11 months ago in which Norman Osborn... well, essentially, the opening is a parallel of the first issue of Ultimate Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking.
It is Norman Osborn in a lab with a doctor talking about the myth of Arachne with one of their experimental spiders. And he's talking to a doctor... Where is your name?
Marcus.
Thank you, yes. About trying to recreate the serum and the genetic modification done to the spider that created Spider-Man. He confides the knowledge into this doctor that he created Spider-Man. And then we get a newspaper page that tells us, Norman Osborn, Green Goblin! And the lab gets shut down. You know, I kind of credit it. It really takes the fact that this new character is black or half black, and it kind of plays with your expectations of it a little bit, because Dr. Marcus here is black.
Mm-hmm.
So me being a boring, white-bred, white person, I think, oh, black character must be connected to Miles Morales somehow.
Right.
Not at all.
Nope. Mm-mm,
nothing to do with him.
Not
he's
a bit.
Black. No, nice little slight racist subversion there, like subversion of racist. Not
it's like a racist test almost. Like, like, are you racist? Like, is this character like you see? Like, you get to the end of that page and you have to take a test. Like, will this character be connected to, you know, Miles? You know, true or false? And it's like, if you say yes, you're a racist.
that could just be like trying to predict what the rest of the book has.
Right, but racist. If the character was white, you wouldn't have thought but that. Wait, I mean, that's the whole thing.
Wait, in all fairness, though, before this comic came out, we were told that Miles was half black and half Hispanic. What I was thinking was like, oh, this must be his father. That's
exactly.
What I was thinking.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. That is a completely racist thing to think, because you assume that because this character is black, he's connected to the other black character.
Too.
Right. Again.
That's the twist.
Right. If Miles was white and this character was white, you would have no reason to necessarily put those two things together.
It's a rather crafty move.
Yeah.
Whether it's deliberate or not, I don't know.
But
feel like it might.
I hope it was, just because it was so good.
Well, the rest of the issue is dedicated to Miles. It's not just like the opening sequence of this that really parallels Ultimate Spider-Man number one. This it's decompressed. You know, it's full on Ultimate 2001. I mean, you know, there are people who have complained at this issue that nothing happens. You know, let me take you back in time 10 years to where people said exactly the same thing. And I know this is going to invite. I'm sure that it has already. That it's invited some parallels with Justice League number one from a couple of weeks ago, because you know the story is really only just getting started. It is just the first installment. But again, I feel that this issue is far much more of a self-contained chunk of story than Justice League 1. And also, it actually stars the character on the cover.
Hey.
He doesn't get into his costume, but then, you know, it took Peter 3 or 4 issues, I think, to get into his costume in the original Ultimate Spider-Man. You know, but he's on the cover, and the Justice League weren't all in their comic.
Right.
But get off Justice League. Miles is attending a lottery to get a seat to the Brooklyn Visions Academy and rather miraculously achieves it. So decides to go and share the news with his uncle.
I think what's really cute about this part was he felt sorry for the other kids that weren't able to get... It shows that he's a compassionate character.
You really know that you might have genuine Spider-Man material when you see that reaction. It's like he goes a long way to making himself being quite a likable, relatable character out of the gate.
Well, the other thing too is there's sort of a social commentary here as well, because this is a very real thing. There's actually a documentary that came out, I think, last year on this very subject, that there are children in low income, you know, families and impoverished, that this is their one hope, and this is exactly how they have to hope to get into school is with a lottery. Mm-hmm. You have to be lucky. And it's
even,
like,
even though the school could be like on the other side of town,
right.
Of course it's going to cost them a fortune, probably more than.
But it's their only
two
right.
Parents make, and
then,
but
you know,
question,
I was like, Peter, this is it's an interesting inversion of the whole Spider-Man lore. It was like where Peter has all this natural aptitude, and you know, great power, great responsibility extends further than just Spidey's powers. Whereas Miles, well, we don't really know if he has any aptitude or not. We know that he's won a lottery.
Well,
great luck.
The implication here is, I mean, it's the way that works is, again, there's advanced academies, but there's more people that qualify to go to them than can get in.
Well, there are 700 applicants here, so, you know, I don't know if there are that many truly gifted kids that would, you know, I don't know.
Well, more so, but I mean, well, I'm sorry, I'm interrupting you, but, I mean, the basic thing here is that the schools that these kids would normally go to are far, I mean, they're like... They're babysitters. I mean, they're worse than that. They're more like prisons. They're more like jails for kids to attend during the day. Whereas these academies or these like private schools that they can try to attend are really their shot at trying to make it. If you go to these schools, you can go to college. Whereas if you're going to the regular schools, your chance at being, you know, becoming a criminal goes up exponentially. So yes, I'm sure he is very intelligent, and it seems that he is on some level. But, you know, there is an element, I think, more of destiny than it seems that Bendis is playing with here because of the numbering in particular.
Yeah, well, the fact that he's got the same number, the lottery ball that pops out of the machine is the same number that's printed on the spider.
And it's 42.
Yeah. 42 meaning
of life. Answer life, the universe, and everything.
To see what you know, with more to learn about this guy, and of course, whether the fact now that he has this great power and great responsibility, if that is the lesson he will learn, is like, how will that impact upon the fact that he has this chance in his own life, which is a chance that he genuinely deserves, you know, and how is that gonna work with the responsibilities he feels with his powers now? You know, it's gonna be, he's gotta live up to his parents. His parents are both alive too. We'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
Yeah, his parents are both alive and they're both together and they all seem happy together.
Yeah, they seem pretty.
It
like
seems
happy
like a
family.
Really,
which would be
really
great.
Yeah, it's a nice, it's happy like, family for once in comics.
And he's a good luck. You know, it's like, he seems like he almost might be one of those kinds of characters who feels like maybe something, you know, is like one of those kinds of characters where like everything's pretty fine, you know, happy, loving family, getting by. He's had the break, but you know, it's like a Disney princess. It's like there must be something more, something mythic.
Well,
and maybe he'll find it in the.
I hope so, but it does seem like there's darker elements to other parts of his life that.
Well, yeah. Going next, you know. He goes to tell his Uncle Aaron the good news, and turns out that they sit around, they talk perfectly happily, but it turns out that his dad really doesn't approve of his uncle, this is his brother, because he believes he's in some shady business. And we as an audience know that he absolutely is. He's actually the ultimate prowler.
Mm-hmm.
Who we see earlier in the comic breaking into the abandoned Oscorp building after Osborn is outed and robbing a safe. And while he's there emptying things out, the spider crawls into his bag. And it is from that bag that it emerges and bites Miles.
It really is amazing how, I mean, shamelessly he stole from his own story in a way and just really like recreated that Peter Parker origin out of Ultimates. And it's like... being played out on the pages of the story.
But again, it's another crafty little use, I don't know if use is the right word, but of the character's race again. Because, like, the Prowler is, apart from Robbie Robertson, like the only black supporting Spider-Man cast member I could name.
Mm-hmm.
There we go.
Yeah.
You know, using it where it counts. And, you know, yeah, the issue ends with Miles has a seizure from the spider bite, passes out, and when he comes around, his dad has come to pick him up. But the dad and uncle start arguing, and Miles runs out, and the issue ends with him displaying a superpower, but not perhaps the power you would imagine. Definitely a power that makes your eyebrow go up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not going to tell you what it is. You got to go read it. You got to go read it to find out.
Definitely an indication, you know, again, without giving away, that he may have a different, slightly different power set, you know.
But, I mean, if anybody's seen the preview for issue number 2, like, I knew about this. But he's also he also does something else in that preview, which might be just strength or might be something else again. So, yeah, wait and see the issue and we'll see what happens. But, yeah. So, altogether, very good first issue. You know, it is decompressed. It is. It is the first part of a story, definitely. But again, it's very dedicated to setting up character relationships, which is exactly how, if anybody remembers, if anybody was reading it back then, how Ultimate Spider-Man started. Like, you know, people were going, oh my God, what is this? You know, Lee and Kirby did it in one issue or whatever, did it in 15 pages. But it's about, it makes me kind of scared for either of the kids' parents, to be honest. Because, you know, Ultimate Spider-Man, when it happened, did a really great job of building up Uncle Ben. To the extent that I remember people wondering if maybe Aunt May was going to die instead because Ben had been so developed.
Mm-hmm.
Which was, of course, just a trick to make it sting all the harder when he actually did die. I'm kind of hoping his parents don't die because I don't want to see just such a wholesale recreation.
I don't want to see that either. Yeah. It'd be nice to see a happy family. You know,
I mean, and it's certainly not as if there aren't more plot elements in place as well, because his uncle Aaron has stolen something in a little red box, which would it just looks like a little ring box. You might think it's just a ring. I mean, whenever the Prowler pulls it out of the safe, looks at it and smiles, I thought it was like, oh look, he's got it. You know, it's like it looks like a little engagement ring box. So you think it's like, oh, he's gonna ask someone to marry him or something. But no, he really, you know, takes it and hides it from Miles when Miles spots it. So there's that, you know, that plot element is in place to see there is more plot here than just Miles Morales gets his powers and begins the story, you know. It quickly and cleanly establishes the character and his relationships and the relationship between the different members of his supporting cast, like his father and his father and his mother and his father and his uncle and him and his uncle and how these things roll. It's just good. I mean, it's Bendis at best, you know. It's Bendis doing a solo character book and hitting all the right notes. And
it's a great number one.
You don't even need to have heard of Spider-Man to read this.
Well, and
I mean, it is genuinely, you know, I mean, I was worried that it would be heavily divorced from Peter Parker's world and supporting cast and didn't want it to be. But after reading it, like, it's divorced. It is completely divorced, but, like, in a really good way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, definitely. And Sarah Pacelli on the artwork as well, as addition to Bendis writing it, who I'm just happy to constantly see more of. I really enjoy her work. And, you know, it's just a really great package all around. Yeah, definitely.
The art is great on this, but the colors are what really make this issue pop.
Was it Ponser?
Johnson Ponser, is it?
Yeah, I mean, the colors are what really... That scene when the Prowler is with the box, that is all made by color, because it's all shading. It's all light. And it's just, you know, it's great. You see that smile on the face. And yeah, it's in the pencils, but what really makes it pop is the colors there. So just an amazing job on the art in this issue. I really like the sort of dot cells in the background of some of these shots as well. And it seems like a very old comic style where you have like the sort of pixelated
Bendy dots. Yeah.
Yeah. And
draws a fantastically menacing Norman Osborn as well.
Oh my God. That look on his face. I was terrified. I was like, I got to put it down. It's scary.
Yeah. It's like there's this double page spread. It's on page 3, and it's like Norman is just smiling happily at Morales, Narcus, and he's like, yes, here's the situation. You'll be working for me now. And then it's like Morales asks, well, can we get Marcus runs through a series of questions. You don't know the specifications of the spider? No, it died. You have a log of measurements? I thought I did, but no. Can we get blood samples of the boy? We have them. And you weren't able to? No. And it's the way that the panels track in closer and closer and gradually cut off the smiling corner of Norman's mouth that just completely transforms the expression, even though everything else is the same. It's when you stop being able to see the curled corner of the mouth that all the more menace comes dripping out, and the increasingly brusque and brief responses. It's a great one of those great fusions of dialogue and art. And it's, you know, it's Bendis dialogue at its strongest as well. So, I mean, solo character books is always where Bendis has shined. And, you know, this is another great one. This is up there with the original Ultimate Spider-Man, and I will happily look forward to more of this.
Excellent.
Quality. Recommended.
Yeah.
All right, sir.
I'm actually interested in Spider-Man now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. It's on my pull list now. I'm reading this, so... Very crazy.
And it is a case where now Ultimate and Amazing will actually be about different things again, because Ultimate has recently, since they got Peter Parker young, hip, swinging, single again, It's kind of called into question what the point of Ultimate Spider-Man is. And now it's a completely different character that is its own thing and has entirely its own reason to exist again and its own type of story to tell and its own cast. So, you know, it's really, it's wins across the board.
Yep.
Recommended reading.
Excellent. All right, sir. Well, let us move on then to Batwoman.
Let us do that thing.
I will let you take it.
I'll just move along with you. I haven't read it yet.
Just read along. Follow along if you will.
Read along as we go. Okay. Now,
it looks Batwoman. Beautiful, I'll tell you that.
Oh my.
Oh God. Yes. Wow.
So Batwoman. This was supposed to come out ages ago. I don't know when exactly. I can't remember. But this was supposed to basically launch about a year ago, 10 months ago, when they overhauled the Bat books last. Whenever the Batman Inc. launched and the new creator came on to Batman and Robin and I believe Snyder started on Detective Comics at the time as well. Like, that was when this was originally supposed to come out. And it didn't. And then they said February. And then they said April. And then they said, no. And I'm assuming somewhere along the line somebody said, right, well, we'll just wait for you, shall we? They decided to move it in to be part of the new 52. So this does not seem to have undergone any great modification since then, except for coloring Jim Gordon's hair red. This seems to pretty much be following on from where Batman and the Bat books were about a year ago. Specifically, this follows on from the Elegy storyline in Detective Comics when Batwoman was originally given her headlining story there by Greg Rucka with art by J.H. Williams III, who I keep calling Freddie Williams because he also has a number in his name sometimes. But it's J.H. Williams III. And I think everyone was perhaps a little bit apprehensive about this whenever they heard that Rucka was leaving DC. He's writing Punisher over at Marvel now. But damn, son. The thing about Batwoman, even when it was on Detective, is as much as there was a quality writer attached to it on Detective, and I'm not slamming any of the writing in this before we get into it. You know, I'll just say it now. I would say that this issue is as well written as any random issue of Rucka's Detective run. Certainly the first four-issue Elegy storyline. But Batwoman is kind of just like you read it for the art. You read Batwoman for its art. It is a fantastic... There are no less than five separate artistic styles in evidence in this book. All by one man who also co-wrote the damn thing. It is a showcase of one man's talent. It's co-written by W. Aidan Blackman as well, who I admit I don't know. And absolute credit must go to Dave Stewart for his colors as well. But anyway, I thought, okay, that's your preamble. So, well, the story.
Can I just say that's like the coolest title page with having dinner?
That's
so awesome.
That is the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, it's just the beginning.
It's going to get just so. The story is called Hydrology, Part 1, Leeching, and it is about some kind of urban legend, what seems to be an urban legend come to life in the slums of Gotham, kidnapping away children. And Batwoman is on the case, while at the same time recapping her history and relationships for the audience, and attempting to train a protege. And that's the issue. Yep. that's the story of it. Not much more to say there. Right. Well, let's see here. Where do we go? Styles. Okay. So you've got across the first two pages as this mysterious. Did they give the creature? And it doesn't really have a name, does it?
No, not yet.
Just figure this watery creature. The story is called Hydrology for a reason. I mean, it is as if these two pages.
She looks like the. I don't know if you've ever heard the legend of the Lady in White. That's what I haven't read the book yet, but that's what it just looks like to me. Is the legend of the Lady in White.
Let's here see if I can find that thing about the urban legend. Well, they believe it's about an urban legend. La Llorona, the weeping woman, an urban legend about a peasant woman who lets her kids drown and then drowns herself and comes back as a vengeful spirit. But these first two pages punctuate that by looking as if they're set underwater. mm-hmm. as the
it looks speaks. Beautiful. It's just absolutely beautiful.
You know, the podcast medium does not do Batwoman justice. But into this world of swirling blues, greens, and whites just comes this crash of red as Batwoman comes through the window. Mm-hmm. You've got, and it's your first introduction to, like, I was going to say duology, but I don't know what you call it, a quintology of styles. You have, to be honest, it's really like there are even six of styles, because you have this style, like this underwater style, where all the pages and panels, like on the first page, it's as if they're running down.
Like, it's a watercolor, panel. Even as far as like the art, it's very watercolor-like.
And then the double page spread is full of swirls as the panels whirl around one another. But then Batwoman comes crashing in, and suddenly you can see it at the very edges of the panels as the swirling wetness gives way to the hard, jagged lightning lines of Batwoman's panels, which were one of the defining features of the Batwoman action scenes in Detective Comics, and you'll see them again over the course of this issue. Sat all atop the daytime scene of the parents speaking to Maggie Sawyer, who is a detective in this now, not a cap. She was a captain in Detective Comics, so rolling her back to a detective seems again to be an artifact of the New 52. But like the daytime civilian scenes are rendered in this solid black lines and lovely bright cell shading. You know, you would believe you were looking at something by someone else. You see more, oh my god, I can't even, you know, articulate properly. You know, Maggie sees this couple. They relate the story of how Batwoman came and sent the woman away, even though their children went missing. And then Maggie sees them out, and it turns out Kate Kane, who we is secretly Batwoman, as we as the audience know, is out in the hallway. Now, the little hint of a relationship sprung up between Maggie and Kate here in Detective Comics. They are lesbians, by the way. Kate still has is still not maybe getting over, but she used to date Renee Montoya, who is the question now. Well, is she still the question in the New 52? We'll see. But if there's two styles, if there's the beautiful painted style of the Batwoman action sequences and the solid line shell shaded coloring of the civilian sequences, there's a style that sort of exists between the two, where the cell shading becomes feathered and the colors darker and the lines thinner, which is basically scene set in the Batcave. Although, I mean, it's her Batcave. There's this beautiful page, which is a picture of her apartment building. And I didn't even realize it at first, but all the panels are set within the geometric structure of the apartment building.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, see the building and you see them walking across the top of the building in the first panel. But then what looks like four other panels are actually four built into the structure of the apartment building right below. It's quite remarkable. She's in the process of training Betty Kane, her cousin, formerly Flamebird, with the Titans. But formerly for me, like, Betty Kane was the original Golden Age Batgirl, if you didn't know. It's like Kate Kane was the original Golden Age Batwoman. Betty Kane was her cousin. I think cousin's right. And the original Batgirl. So, frankly, I mean, she's not letting her have a costume. She's just training her in gray jumpsuit. But, you know, I look at this and go, yeah, there's somebody else who could have been Batgirl. We didn't, and we could have still had Oracle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you know, they go out training, and there's we talked about how Marcos Martin draws like four dimensionally.
Yeah,
draws time. You get another instance of that where this is beautiful is understating it. Double page spread of the characters somersaulting, vaulting, running across a rooftop, all encapsulated within a large panel that is half Batwoman's logo, half Flamebird's logo. With other panels.
Oh,
like,
that's cool. Hey, yeah. Actually,
by the way, fanning out across the top. And then little panels, well, not even panels, but just like very thin bounding boxes within this larger panel, which show the characters like at different moments in time, but they're bleeding in and out of the boxes. It's so hard to describe without seeing it, but trust me, it's fantastic.
No, you're doing a great job describing it, because I wouldn't be able to do it.
But that's like three of the styles. And then we see the Department of Extranormal Operations, agent and Director Bones, who is a guy with a black skeleton head. That's all you really need to know, is putting Agent Chase.
He lives up to his name.
Well, Agent Chase here, he's putting her on the case of finding out who Batwoman is. Now, Agent Chase was actually a character that J.H. Williams used to draw, and DC is about to publish in a couple of months a complete collection of his work on the Chase series, so some synergy going on there. And, and then the other style really comes in whenever Kate's father turns up at the cave after they return from their night out, and we get, oh my God, look at all the... so pretty. big sweeping history of Batwoman, essentially quickly summarizing the events of Elegy and the three-part story that followed Elegy, which is contained in the hardcover and paperback collections of Elegy, which shows what happened to Kate's twin sister. And it's a looser, sketchier, more minimalist, I guess maybe more noirish, or it's hard to describe, but it's a whole nother style. And you'll see Kate and her father and her in military dress uniform rendered in that style as well. And she refuses to reconcile it with her father, finding out
this
that he
styles
kept
more like Day of the Dead style.
I'm not sure. and then the issue ends with Batman appearing to make Batwoman a proposition, and you know it's quite like exposition heavy in some spots, but you know it's not like the writing is workmanlike or anything. It's solid writing, but this is a book about the art. This is about the art.
Mm-hmm.
I think I said this before once when I talked about Elegy, when I talked about Elegy briefly on the show. It's like you think you know what a comic can look like. It's like comic art has sort of gradually evolved over time, but you have a pretty solid idea. It's like it's not like we're dealing with six panel pages anymore, but you basically think you understand the laws and the different ways that a comic book page can be put together. Well, J.H. Williams is here to blow your tiny mind.
Mm-hmm.
He is here to do things with a comic book page that you have never seen before. And you will thank him.
It plays with time. It plays with, you know, the way that you visualize things. It's, you know, the commentary, I think, on comics has become, in a sense, that comics can't do... what you can do in comics, you can do in film. And even Morrison has said that, you know. Well, the new medium for superheroes is film, because you can pretty much accomplish on film whatever you can. In comics, and J.H. Williams just flips a big bird to that and says, "No, you fucking can't
do this, bitches."
Yeah, because the elements that he places together, the moments, the way that the art changes how you feel about what is going on in the scene, there is absolutely no way to accomplish that on film and not make your audience nauseous.
We are lucky that an artistic talent of this magnitude deigns to produce comics.
Mm-hmm.
This is the stuff of legend.
Yeah.
There is no other comic that looks like Batwoman. And, you know, even if you don't read the words, you're still getting your $3 worth.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. My God. No, perhaps to try and force myself to step away from the art, I will talk about some other things that I really quite enjoy. Well, to do that, I'll just do my history with Batwoman briefly. I had a lot of issues with Batwoman when she first appeared in 52. Because she was a headline grabber. She was not a character. Batwoman was a prop. When Batwoman first appeared, Batwoman grabbed headlines with the fact that she was a lesbian. Oh my God, everybody sit up and pay attention. They let a lesbian be in comics.
Mm-hmm.
And that she
was
Jewish.
Right.
And that she was Jewish. She's not a character in 52. She appears and then is essentially a prop in Renee Montoya's story, where she's captured and is going to be used as a sacrifice. And then DC would essentially wheel her out for like the Christmas specials. If they needed to do a Hanukkah-themed story, she was like the only Jewish superhero they had. So there she was. And she would just randomly pop up in places.
Because nobody remembers DC... Ragman or what.
But they had, you know, and it would have been one thing if that was it, but DC really didn't want us to forget that this character existed, even though she had done nothing to be deserving of our attention. Every time there had to be a double-page splash, like, assemblage of DC's characters, or if there would be a poster with DC's characters on it, there would be Batwoman. I remember one of the most egregious instances of it was, I don't know if you remember that beautiful... Adam Hughes freeze of all the DC you could buy it as a poster, but like sections of it were printed in comics as a central double page. But this is a couple of years ago, and it was just a collection of all of DC's famous females, Power Girls, living legend characters of legend: Catwoman, Power Girl, Supergirl, Zatanna, Poison Ivy, Harley Quinn, Wonder Woman. There are probably some more I'm forgetting off the top of my head, but you know, real female legends of DC, and then just all in beautiful white flowing ball gowns. Like, it was called The Real Power Behind DC. You know, it's a beautiful piece of work. And parked in the middle of it, sat in a chair, elbows up on her knees, wearing a pantsuit, because God help you if you forget she's a lesbian, was about
God,
who had just been around for like a year. And DC were insistent on pushing and pushing this character to make us care, even though they, like, the stories had done nothing. But even then, when they announced that she was being given the starring role in Detective Comics, I did not go, ugh. I went, well, now is the chance to really do something with her. I looked upon it with positivity. And, you know, I was right to, because it turned out, they turned her into a character instead of a gay prop for Renee Montoya to bounce her stories off of. The fact is, Batwoman was introduced in 52, and that's 2006?
Yeah.
Yeah, 2006. And Detective Comics was 2010. 2009-10, yeah. So she'd been around for three, four years, and she before they even bothered to give her an origin. We knew not how Kate Kane had become Batwoman until Detective Comics happened. That's how little, like, attention was paid to that aspect of her. She was there to grab headlines with what she was, not who she was. And, she was a sexy lipstick lesbian as well. And that's an element that Detective Comics just completely stripped away. They cut her hair down short, turned her to this pallid shade, and put these tattoos on her. And she went to parties dressed in a tuxedo and publicly danced with Maggie Sawyer, you know. But I respect this comic even more so, because it's like, it's really just, by the way, I'm a lesbian.
Mm-hmm.
Detective Comics dedicated whole scenes to them, beautifully drawn scenes, absolutely, but to double page spreads to her and Maggie, lesbians in tuxedos, because all lesbians must always wear man clothes, swaying across the dance floor with all the looks from everybody. I mean, obviously, it was there was an element in 52 where the Kate was still in the closet. That sort of just was casually forgotten about, really, I think. But, you know, she was very publicly out in Detective Comics. And, you know, it was a great scene as far as such things can be judged. But just as I was saying about how with Ultimate Spider-Man, back when he was revealed in Fallout, it still had to be a big, oh, look at this, look and acknowledge at this, that he is black and that she is gay. And here it's just like, yeah, you want to go out? Yeah, okay, right, I'm going to do some superhero stuff now.
Yeah, I gotta punch people in the face now. I'll be back.
Like, it's not treated as something completely deserving of all this illicit attention. It's just normal, and that is the way to do this sorts of things.
Yes,
yeah, like, I can't wait to go deal. Back and actually read this, because that the cover is awesome. The cover,
I know.
Yeah,
that I mean, you could just sit there and stare at it. You just keep on looking into it.
That scene in particular, where she and Maggie actually agree to go out for a date, is she's looking at a picture of Renee in the in the hall of the police station. I mean, it makes you wonder if... No, I don't believe this is supposed to be any reflection of the New 52, like maybe Renee's dead or something, and this is fallen officers. Like, but it's like the specter of Renee is looming over her. But it is punctuated wordlessly in this beautiful panel, a completely black and white panel, solid, and it's not like painted. It's the solid black line style of the civilian sequences. Mm-hmm. White, black line work. The only thing that's in color is Renee's picture, this tiny little postage stamp size image on the page in one large panel, just going, yeah, that's going to haunt you. You're not over that. And, you know, you get the feeling that that's going to come back. And I think, you know, lots of people are waiting to see what happens with Renee as well, because Renee is a great character. Some people support her being the question. Some people don't. I'm fairly ambivalent one way or the other, because I never read Gotham Central. But yeah. And you know, it's the casualness with which they, you know, it's like Greg Rucka was kind of into like sexing up the whole idea that she was a lesbian. And certainly that was something that always seemed to weigh pretty heavily on Renee, because 52 was filled with a few gratuitous scenes like that. And I remember that the Books of Blood miniseries that followed up her adventure after 52 had an issue almost solely dedicated to her banging chicks. but it's refreshingly, strangely even desexualized in this, where it's treated as just the most ordinary thing. And even when she and Bette are stripping off their clothes to put on their costumes, it's in this beautifully sexless way.
Mm-hmm.
Even they're standing there completely bare-arsed at one point, and I'm like, ooh, no. It's all white and the tattoos and everything. You know, and you simply see the simple folds of flesh in Bette's stomach in a way you wouldn't normally in any kind of skin-bearing female. It's a fascinatingly desexualized approach to this aspect of the character that, you know, really, yeah, I'm very done with this.
And in terms of that, though, there's even a great example of that, which is the scene just below, the shot just below. Where they're going out, and it's the part Batwoman, part Flamebird logo. In that sequence, you see Batwoman like jumping over a wall, and hey, her boots covering up the crack of her ass instead of actually like displaying it to the world. Whereas if this
that was one of those really little subtle things that Williams did with it in Detective Comics. Like, you would look at this, and you wouldn't really immediately notice any differences in this costume to the traditional. Way to the way she appeared in 52, but no, like he's given her, you know, flat boots, and he's given her, it's like she used to have a belt that hung like a sash, you know, like just off the hip, all sexy like, but no, he gave her a proper tightened up belt and gloves with real gauntlets. And the whole point of her getting her hair cut was so that it couldn't be grabbed and pulled. It couldn't be like long flowing sexy locks, because that's just not functional. Because it turned out that her dad was a military man, and her dad actually trained her in this. Her dad trained her and was her Alfred. Well, I guess he was more like her Henry Ducard. And she's the, yeah. It was, you know, simply covering up the crack of her arse is one of the more obvious ways that he... you know, that's very true, actually. I'd forgotten about that until you made me remember. But, like, yeah, one of the first steps he made was really desexualizing her visually. Now that Rucka's not writing it, he seems to have gone so far as to just sort of desexualize that element. Because Batman is, you know, a very desexualized entity. Mm-hmm. Unless you throw
it out. I still think she's got the good sexy looks going on.
Well,
she's
she is, but it's not like... Well,
it's
okay.
It's not like right in your face.
When you have like Suicide Squad, where Harlequin is basically nearly naked, and there's like one shot that I saw even from that where it's like she's being interrogated by a woman's ass. You know, you know, when you come to this and you show you have just enough to be interesting, but not so much that it's like, here's an ass and here's tits, you know. It's refreshing, I think, in that way.
You know, but it's like to even dwell on the visual aspect of that is to give it more, give that idea like more credit than it's worth.
Right.
To comment, to draw that out of the art, because, like I said, even if you don't read the words, you're still getting $3. You're getting, I don't know. I mean, this is like, I'm just worried about how this book's going to keep its schedule. I mean, he's had nearly a year of lead time, so I better see at least 6 issues in the can before there's any filler artists.
Right. Yeah, and that will kill this because it's so much about the art.
I was a little bit hesitant about picking this up purely because of the length of time and my general hesitancy to jump into the Bat books, like back when. But I figured New 50, you know, back when it was originally supposed to come out. But I really figured New 52, picking up a bunch of stuff, let's go for it. And not an ounce of regret, you know. You should pick it up too, and you're wrong if you don't.
Yeah.
And that's Batwoman.
Excellent. So, awesome. Well, there you go. That's our show. That's it. So, you know, a little bit over maybe the schedule that we had wanted, but we're getting better, people. We're going to try not to keep you around for like 3 hours at a time. So,
yeah.
Anyway,
We only really ran long on that one at the end there because Triplett's not here. We'd have kept it more concise if he wasn't. That's about an hour and a half.
Yeah, it's just an hour and a half. So
It's an hour and a half,
but with only... You know, if it had been four, is what I was saying. If it had been four of us.
We did Spider Island in, you know.
Yeah.
Because we missed Triplett. We know how he likes his Spidey. So.
Right. Yeah.
We'll keep keep the top of the show book tighter in future episodes.
No, we'll keep the end of this shorter, so I'm going to get the heck out of here. Yeah. So, show is recording at a new time. If you didn't notice, we're recording now at 4 p.m., Eastern Time, 9 p.m. GMT. So you can catch us live at tfradio.net/live or download the podcast in any of your favorite places to do so. Stitcher as well. If you're listening to just the video version of this, if you want to download it, you can go to Stitcher, which is really cool. Easy, quick way to download the show. But, you know, iTunes or whatever you want to do. So, anyway, that's it. That's our show. Go to fanboyversus.com. Follow us on Twitter at fanboyvs. You can also link to our Twitters as well off of the TF Radio Network page. So, again, for Chris McFeely, for Nicole Hale, and for Chris Triplett, who couldn't be here this week, I'm J.D. Church. Thanks so much for joining us. And please tune in next time when it'll be Fanboy versus...
This has been Fanboy versus... Visit us at tfradio.net for show notes and to subscribe to the podcast. Follow us on Twitter at TF Radio for news and updates. Like the podcast? Leave us feedback on iTunes. Copyright 2011, Radio Free Cybertron.